Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
The Dan Bernstein Show. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
A lot more disruptive if we had a game, we had a game tonight. In this situation, we're able to move pieces around, and today was going to be a live BP light day anyway. You know, we'll move some of those guys that we're going to throw today to tomorrow and adjust some schedules. So we're able to do that fairly easily in this setting. You know, it's completely different, though, if we're playing a game, and you're very, very rarely going to have an instance where five guys are hurt on the same day at the same, when we get these pending tests, you know, that's the unique part about this is when are we going to get them back?
That is Cubs pitching coach Tommy Hotovy, because the Cubs had to be on delay yesterday because there were six tests that they were waiting on, and then they got five negatives and one that they think the test might have been corrupted. Either way, there have been hiccups for a lot of teams and too many delays in trying to determine who may have COVID-19 and who does not. Here to talk about that and everything that MLB is trying to do regarding their own testing facilities is Sports Illustrated staff writer Emma Bacciolari, who joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. How are you, Emma?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. So It sounded great when they started, with baseball able to say, hey, I know you're worried about us maybe taking up important resources or jumping to the front of the line, but guess what? We have our own research and testing laboratory that we can snap our fingers and convert it to COVID testing. It doesn't sound like it was quite as easy as it sounded when they announced it.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things here is that it is a really complicated process for any lab anywhere in the country to be dealing with the demand that they're seeing right now for COVID tests, to be adjusting to all the new developments that are being found out. And when it comes to kind of just getting a lab to switch to this entirely new stuff from scratch, like in MLB's case, a drug testing lab, which, you know, yes, is a laboratory, but it's doing entirely different stuff usually than the type of test that you need done for COVID. When you're asking them to kind of jump into that seat first without any experience in that field, to scale up really quickly to do a ton of tests, you know, when you're talking about one lab to process all 30 teams, you know, we're not only talking about players and managers, but we're talking about, you know, a lot of people on staff, the clubhouse attendants, you know, everyone on the coaching staff, physical therapists. That's a lot of tests when you're multiplying it by 30 teams. When you're asking one lab to address all of that, and it's all new to them, you can have some problems. And I think we've seen a lot of those just in the last week since stuff really got up and running.
So the context now is that they have at least capitulated and said, well, we might actually need a second lab. And I believe it was Rutgers where they were going to start sending samples also. But then there are going to be new complications with that about what sample goes where. Are certain teams dedicated to certain labs, et cetera? What happens now that they are actually recognizing that they're going to need more help?
Yeah, so what they're saying right now about the lab at Rutgers that they signed a contract with is that Rutgers will only process non-player samples. So when you're talking about kind of those people who are in what MLB is calling tier two, so not coaches and managers and people who have direct contact with players all the time, but that other sizable chunk of people who are on a staff you know, the head groundskeepers, translators, people in that kind of group, their samples in some cases will be sent to Rutgers. And the hope is that with a second lab to process some of this stuff, you won't have as many backlogs. They'll be able to kind of navigate around any potential, you know, delays that crop up. And if they do need to change something later on where they do decide they want to send player samples out to Rutgers because they need to do that for teams on the East Coast or whatever, they have that lot lined up already. So the hope is that that should help a little. And in the event that down the line they need something to help a lot, it'll be right there.
You mentioned the tiering system, and it's great that they're trying to do that, to try to make sure that and understand that some people need to be tested more often. But that's all gray areas too, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of arbitrary how they can assign someone to a tier and not necessarily be fully aware of contact, of access. And really what matters is for each team is who's breathing the same recirculated air in the same places and for how much time and who's downwind of whom. How reliable and can that tiering system actually be?
Yeah, that's a really great point. And that's something that you saw Rich Hill bring up in Minnesota last week. You know, he said, okay, I'm getting tested every other day. My pitching coach is getting tested every other day. Why are the clubhouse attendants who I see, you know, every single day, spend time with, or breathing the same air, touching the same stuff, why are they only tested twice a week? Because, yeah, it's a great point. Like, when you're trying to make the system that MLB has work, when you're trying to play in home ballparks, you're not in a bubble. People are going home every night. People are traveling, that sort of thing. You do have to be, you know, really rigorous about this testing. And it's a hard balance to strike with, you know, how do we do this fast? How do we make it accurate? How is it rigorous? How does it not tax the public too much in terms of the resources you're taking up? But if you want this to be like an ideal system, it does seem like a problem for some experts who are looking at it that, you know, you divided people into tiers. They're still spending a lot of time together, all of them. They're still doing a lot of work together. And some of them aren't tested as frequently as others.
Joey Gallo tested positive twice with the test that MLB is using. That's a saliva test. He then tested negative twice over the same period of time because he wanted to get the more reliable nasal swab test, which he did so privately. And that's one singular example. But aren't there large scale questions about the overall accuracy of the saliva test that MLB's using?
Yeah, so this is a challenging thing because I think pretty much all scientists agree the nasal test is going to be more accurate. But when you're looking at a testing program that involves guys doing these tests every other day, you know, I don't think there's anyone out there who wants to have that nasal test three times a week, that, you know, that Q-tip that goes insanely far up your nose. It can be pretty unpleasant. And also as a question of resources, you know, those swabs are kind of they're a hot commodity. If you're going to be taking up that many swabs, like, mm-hmm. that can be a problem in some areas. So they've turned to the saliva test instead, which is easier to collect. It's cheaper, but it's also, it's not as accurate. And you saw that with Joey Gallo. And, you know, I think it does show that there can be some problems here, that when you're looking at, you say, like, it's only 1 or 2 percentage points of a difference in terms of accuracy. But there is a difference between 98% and 99% accurate when you're talking about a sample pool of 1,800 players. Like, that's going to crop up. And it's already cropped up with Joey Gallo.
We're talking with Emma Bacciolari, staff writer for Sports Illustrated on Sports Radio 670 The Score, about MLB, their testing regimen, and how it's all going. And then this isn't even to ask the other question that you address in your very thorough story, and that's, is it okay? You talk about hot commodity. We can also interchange that term finite resource, and that there may be ethical questions here about a finite amount of actual tests of how these labs should be used and for whom, and reagents that have to be used. That these are actual commodities that they may be hoarding for their own purposes and own gain, and that may not be okay in the eyes of some.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a tough thing to look at, because when MLB was setting this program up and writing the manual You know, you're talking about early June, the middle of June. You know, at that point, it looked like stuff was a lot better in a lot of places. You know, like testing capacity has gone way up around the country. And a lot of places, you know, they weren't really strained with that. Cases, you know, were not in a super worrying place in terms of like, oh, no, is an area, you know, going to have a really huge spike. But, you know, fast forward a month later, and even with that increased testing capacity, it's really strained in a lot of areas, you know, including some major league cities, places like Houston, like Phoenix, you know, all over Florida. Tests can be hard to get now. People are waiting for a long time. Their results can't be turned around quickly. And so when you're talking about creating the infrastructure to process as many tests as MLB needs, which is about 14,000 a week, you know, some experts and some scientists do look at that and say, like, can you say that that is right and that is fair? That, yes, it is a private laboratory that MLB has funded to convert to COVID testing. So it's not directly taking resources out of the public, and that is a good thing. But at the same time, you know, like you said, they are using those reagents. They're using some of the supplies that could be directed elsewhere. And, you know, maybe 3 weeks ago, a month ago, that wouldn't have been such a problem. But right now, in some areas, that really kind of is.
As you were researching this and talking to some players about it, how routine is it getting? How much is this just now? Are they actually adapting to it? And how many are still seemingly bothered by just how weird this all is?
You know, I think there's a mix. I think guys realize, obviously, this is super important. You know, they're grateful to be able to have the chance to play. But yeah, I mean, it is weird. A lot of this is weird. Even something like the saliva test, like you say, it sounds so easy, but the way that they're doing it, you can't eat or drink for 30 minutes before. You have to spit like kind of a lot into the little cup they give you. It's not just like, you know, one loogie and you're done. So it's even something as basic as that can feel kind of weird, you know. Just looking at how thorough all of these guidelines and stuff they have to adapt to are, like, there's a lot. Like, it's making the game different, and it's a lot to get used to. And they have, you know, a couple of weeks here in summer camp to kind of adjust. But I think for a lot of it, it's going to take a while to settle in and click. And, you know, it is, I think, nice to be able to play baseball in a new normal. But it's clear that, like, this is never going to feel like the old normal.
Emma, as we let you go, speaking of new normal and old normal, how are things in general at Sports Illustrated now after all the headlines and the upheaval and furloughs and so much that's going on? For those of us who have such strong and fond memories of the print edition and growing up and have where the Sports Illustrated name carried just an outsized meaning for those of us, those middle-aged folks who remember getting the first issue with Mark Fidrich on it in 1976, are things settling in at SI?
You know, I think it's a tough time for a lot of print media, not just us. It's definitely different, making do with less, but, you know, there's still a set of people out here who are trying to do the best job telling stories that we can, and grateful to still be one of them. And yeah, we're still out here trying to fight the good fight with that. So hopefully
good.
We can keep it going.
It's good to hear because, you know, you never know with some bosses and when you get the private equity people involved and you don't know how much they care about telling the stories. It does my heart good every time I look at another one of these long form magazine pieces that's so well researched and well done by smart people. So here's to more.
Thanks. Yep.
Emma Bacciolari of Sports Illustrated, our guest on Sports Radio 670 The Score. Let's talk hockey next. We started out discussing the absence of Corey Crawford and what that means to any founded or wild optimism that anybody may have had for the Blackhawks. But the fact is they were out there. They were on that ice at Fifth Third Arena, which, by the way, every hockey player I talk to says best ice he's ever played on. Actually, people who say it's so much better than the United Center, even because it's like state of the art. And because they don't have the giant arena there, they can keep it colder in there. But everybody that I've talked to, youth players, adult men's league guys, who've said that the Fifth Third Arena is the best ice that they have played on anywhere in Chicago, or perhaps outside of Edmonton. So apparently they absolutely got that right. I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know the damn difference. But the Blackhawks were out there. They were skating. They're practicing. And Mark Lazarus will tell us all about it next on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
Corey's unfit to play or to participate. So it's an opportunity for now for those other guys to compete. And we'll probably rotate those three guys, Subban, Delia, and Lankinen. We'll rotate them through the first group. And it's a great opportunity for them and a great opportunity for us to evaluate them. And we expect a lot of competition. And we have confidence in all three of those guys that they're going to make it hard on us and play at a high level.
That is Blackhawks head coach Jeremy Colliton. Unfit to play, those three words to describe Corey Crawford, and leave it, of course, to the NHL to not tell us ahead of time that that's going to be their catch-all term for guys who are out for whatever reason. And again, when it comes to Corey Crawford, again, we have the unknown. Here to help us sort through the Blackhawks' return to the ice is Mark Lazarus. He got to take it all in at Fifth Third Center yesterday. Mark Lazarus is on Twitter, at Mark Lazarus. He writes for The Athletic, and he is on the Alpamonte Ford hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. So, Laz, it sounded like it had to be very, very strange, but a little bit comforting to hear those sights and sounds again, see those sights and hear those sounds.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I didn't know what to expect going in there. When you walk in, they have this, like, futuristic scanner. You just look at a screen and it tells you your temperature within a tenth of a degree, so it kind of sets you off in a weird start. But then you just go up and they're out there playing hockey. You know, it's, you know, the coaches are wearing masks, which is weird, but good to see that, especially the older ones that are at a little more risk. But the players just out there practicing and skating and shooting and, you know, goofing around and cracking jokes. And it was kind of surreal to be there in the middle of July, because it could have just been in the middle of March the way a normal season would go. It's going to take some time to get used to this.
And the goalie situation is the first thing that we're going to deal with hockey-wise. And we know the names that we heard Colliton say. You know, you got Malcolm Subban, you got Colin Delia, and you got Kevin Lankinen. But what, do you have 9 practices in which to determine your goalie for the playoffs? I mean, how do you do this?
Well, I mean, Subban and Delia have NHL experience. Lankinen's won an international tournament with Finland, so he's got experience in this kind of level, but it's hard to imagine him coming off a surgery leapfrogging those other two guys. I think Subban has the inside track, but it's tough. I mean, we don't know if Crawford's going to be back in the next 2.5 weeks. We don't know what unfit to play means. That's the catch-all term right now. He wasn't in phase 2 practices either, so this is something that's been going on at least for a little while. He was, I think, the only prominent player who wasn't in Chicago for any of phase 2. The voluntary work. I don't know what this means, and they can't tell us what this means, but Colliton certainly sounded like a guy who wasn't expecting to have Corey Crawford against the Oilers, which didn't apply because he's the best player on the team. He is the most important player on the team. For years, we always talked, who's more irreplaceable, Keith, Kane, Taves. But right now, it's Crawford. This last couple of years, the goaltending has been what's kept the Blackhawks even mildly competitive. And you take Crawford out, who had a 927 or 928 save percentage over the last 3 months of the season, and replace him with Subban, who had about an 890, Delia, who spent all of last year in the minors, Lankinen, who spent all of last year in the minors and is coming off an injury. It's a huge drop-off, and those guys are capable goalies, but they're not Corey Crawford. They don't have that playoff experience that Corey Crawford has. So it's, you know, we went from Hawks aren't going to make the playoffs to Hawks have a real chance to win this series against the Oilers to Hawks have no chance against the Oilers again. So the mood swings have been pretty wild.
We talked about it to start the show, and that is when we actually look at the numbers, if you were to make a statistical argument, you could say that Corey Crawford is certainly the second best goaltender in the history of the Chicago Blackhawks. And if you want to argue relatively because of the overall improvement at the position and an understanding of the meaning of the position, that there could be a reasonable intellectual argument that he is objectively the best goalie in the history of the franchise. Why do so many people seem to actively not want to appreciate that?
Yeah, you know, I feel like I fought this battle for the last 8 years. The Corey Crawford Underappreciation Society. I thought it changed. I thought there was the 2016 World Cup, when Mike Babcock named Crawford the backup goalie behind Carey Price for Team Canada, ahead of Braden Holtby, who had just won the Vezina. I kind of put that as the line of demarcation. I'm like, okay, Corey Crawford is no longer underappreciated. He's no longer underrated. He's got the two Stanley Cups. He should have won a Conn Smythe in 2013. He is one of the best goalies in the world. And now if Mike Babcock says it's true, if he's playing number two for Team Canada, he is by definition one of the best goalies in the world. And then the concussion stuff happened and he missed a lot of time. And I think people kind of forgot. They forgot how good he was that half a season leading up to the first concussion. And then they don't pay attention to how good he's been the last couple of years because the Blackhawks haven't been good. He's one of those guys where if you take him off the Blackhawks, they are the maybe one of the worst teams in the league by a wide mile. He and Robin Leonard were terrific this year. And you take Leonard away, and it was all Crawford. He was fantastic. Since New Year's, he was all-world goalie. I don't know why people don't want to give him Crawford. I always joke, you know, he's from Montreal area. If he had a French-Canadian last name, he'd be considered a Hall of Famer right now, just because that's what you demand of your goalies. But I agree with you. I think, you know, you got Tony Esposito, you got Glenn Hall, you got Eddie Belfour. Corey Crawford's resume stands up to all of them. I think he probably will go down as the best goalie in team history.
Talking with Mark Lazarus on Sports Radio 670, The Score. How did Brent Seabrook look? Just a first glimpse, how is he moving? How has he come off of these multiple surgeries?
He looked a lot better than I expected him to look, considering he had, you know, surgery on both hips and a shoulder. This is a major, major surgery in the last 6-7 months. There were times where I thought he looked a little tentative, a little like he was moving a little gingerly, but he was playing. He was out there. He was enough, you know, wasn't wearing like some kind of non-contact sweater. He was going hard. He skated the 20 minutes of laps they did at the end. He skated him, much to his chagrin, it looked like, by the look on his face. But he was out there for the full hour and 15 minutes, you know, cutting and stopping and shooting and you know, flying down the ice as best he could. I don't think he's at 100%. I think it's unrealistic to expect him to be, and I still don't think he's going to play in this series. I don't think that's what's best for the Blackhawks or for him in the long run, and more time before risking any more injury. But he is much farther along than I think anyone could have anticipated. And, you know, his teammates yesterday, Taves and Keith in particular, were just raving about what it says about him. I know everybody always wants to crap on Brent Seabrook, but, man, you can't count the guy out. He's not going to go out like this.
I'm just wondering if he gets a reset on some of the conditioning issues that he's had. I mean, I've made fun of him, too, for looking a little roly-poly as he has aged. But maybe with something like this, when you get scared straight, and, I mean, I know from experience having torn up a knee, and where the doctor says, you know what, if you can absolutely keep weight off as best you can, you're going to delay your inevitable next procedure. So is this the kind of thing where he could turn a negative into that kind of positive?
It could be. I mean, you know, Brent Seabrook is never going to be Duncan Keith. He's never going to look like Jonathan Toews. He doesn't have that body type, and he doesn't have that fanaticism about his fitness. And he's 34, 35 years old, too. There's you know, as you and I know, as you get older, it gets harder to get in perfect shape. But what I'm interested to see is, you know, he was never fast to begin with. The reason he fell to the Blackhawks at was number 14 overall way back in 2003 is because he was slow. And nobody wanted to draft him because he's slow. But for 10 years, that didn't matter because he's smart. He's, you know, offensive mind. He's got a great pass, a great shot. He knows where to play. You can overcome your lack of speed with savvy positioning. The last few years, he lost half a step from an already slow step. Now you wonder, okay, well, if he's been dealing with hip issues for this long, if they can really fix his hips, if he gets that half a step back and just gets back to regular slow Brent Seabrook as opposed to super slow Brent Seabrook, maybe there's more left in that tank. I think that's what he's hoping. That's what his teammates have been saying all along since he got the surgery. You don't understand what he's been dealing with, the pain he's been in the last couple of years. That's what every player kept telling me that. He never complained, but you could see it. And now maybe if it's cleaned up and maybe if his hips start working again, he can get back to that regular Brent Seabrook level, which was an all-star Olympian caliber player.
It's a hell of a rallying cry. Let's get back to regular slow.
Regular Seabrook. Right. I was not going to be regular me, man.
Right. I mean, if the system that Calton has been instilling here has taken in fits and starts, it seems that the younger players may have accepted some of this more than the older players have. Where are we in general as they reconvene? And you mentioned that they were doing, you know, getting back to some of their regular drills. Where are we in the overall adaptation of Colleton's coaching, in large part by some veteran players who have been very set in their ways?
It's a great question. It's amazing that we're 2 years into this Jeremy Colleton experience, and we really don't know what he looks like as a coach. We don't know what his system looks like. His first year, he was dropped in midstream on an old team with a changing roster, and it never really took hold. The next year, we're like, okay, he's finally got this training camp. We're finally going to see what it is. And then he loses Andrew Shaw, Brent Seabrook, Callum DeHaan, and they're dealing with injuries, and then a pandemic hits. We really don't know what this team is supposed to look like. But this is the third youngest team in the 2014 turn right now. I know we think of the Blackhawks as these old guys, but they've only got four or five old guys. This is a very young team, and they're the ones that are going to have to take the mantle and kind of create this new system. And then Taves talked about this a lot last year. The young guys need to kind of take some of the lead, and the older guys have to kind of follow their lead. I don't know what a Jeremy Colliton season looks like because we haven't seen one yet. It's bizarre to think that it's been this long and we really don't know what his style is, his system is, because he's constantly adapting it to the personnel he has. And then, extenuating circumstances keep getting in the way. This is, this commitment is whatever it's going to be. It's going to be crazy. But that next season, whenever it starts in December or January or whatever, if they get a full 82 games, 2020, 2021, that's going to be the defining season for Jeremy Colliton. It has to be, because at some point you have to make a decision on whether this is working or not.
And you mentioned that they skated laps at the end of that practice like they're a high school team. And this is so how are they going to do this? Because I know that NHL players are going to start grumbling after a while. He's not going to go full bag skate on him, but they must have seen something in the conditioning or in the spring in their step where they feel that they've got to do some extra conditioning at the end of practice.
I don't know. It looked like a mid-September first day of training camp practice. That's what they do the first few days. They just skate them, the conditioning skates after a long, hard practice. Then they just, push them on the edge of puking. It's a standard operating procedure for the first couple of days. If they're still doing this a week and a half from now, right before leaving for Edmonton, then trouble. Then something's wrong. But, I mean, all these guys, they've only been on the ice for a few weeks. Most of them didn't have access to ice for all of March, April, and most of May. So I think that's the biggest hurdle to overcome in this two-week training camp is conditioning. And the good thing is, an NHL training camp is only about 2.5 weeks to begin with. There's usually a few preseason games in there. But this is almost a full-length training camp. They have the ability to get everybody ready. The difference is there's no dipping your toe in the water. There's no early October hockey to kind of get your feet wet. You're diving right into a playoff series. Not only that, but a five-game playoff series where that game one is crucial. So they're going to have to get these guys up to mid-season form in the middle of July when their bodies aren't used to it after 3 months of being mostly idle. It's a huge task, but it's a task that 23 other teams are dealing with too.
There's no bubble either, and there is a tremendous amount of trust and the among teammates. It's one thing that we've seen in Major League Sports that I think can set an example for society writ large, and that is be a good teammate. And make that commitment to making sure you're doing safe and smart things, because nobody wants to be that guy. Nobody wants to be the guy that brings it all crashing down because he went out to a bar and did something stupid or took a risk that was unnecessary. Have they talked openly about that? And are team leaders stressing? And because I was a little troubled by Jonathan Toews saying nobody knows how you get COVID. Well, yeah, you kind of do, and we know. those risky behaviors are. And I didn't know if he was just kind of, because I know he reads and he's aware, so it surprised me to hear that from him. But I would like to hear the team leaders talking about that and about what it means now more than ever to be a good teammate.
Well, let me touch on the Toews thing real quick first. The problem with this Zoom setup for these conference calls is we can't follow up on anything. You ask your question, you're immediately muted, and then the player answers, and then someone else asks the next question. So, I would have loved to have clarified when he said, if I was talking one on one with Jonathan Toews right there, and he said, "We don't know how the virus is spread," I would have stopped him right there and I said, "What do you mean by that?" And we don't get the opportunity to clarify this. So, I don't want to put too much stock in what he said, but I too was a little, I raised my eyebrows when he said, "We don't know how this is spread." We know exactly how this spread. This isn't a belief thing, this is a science thing. But beyond that, Duncan Keith and Jeremy Colliton both emphasized exactly what you were talking about, that the first thing they talked about when they got to the rink yesterday was, you are accountable. We are counting on you, and there's a trust here that you're not going to blow this for everybody else. You have to be really, really careful these next couple of weeks to not put yourself in a position where you're going to bring that into the locker room. If you bring that into a locker room, I don't care how careful you're being and how many masks you're wearing and what you're doing with soap bottles and things like that, you're going to decimate that roster. So there is a huge risk these next couple of weeks. I think I would have liked to have seen somehow if they could have done training camps, all of them, all 24 of them in Edmonton and Toronto. Lord knows there's enough hockey rinks in those two cities. I think an extended bubble would have been a better idea than this. Having everyone in the home, hell, having us media in the building. We're nowhere near the players. It's almost impossible for us to get within 100 feet of them, but, we're there. There's just all these unnecessary risks that you'd like to see them lock it down a little harder. But it is going to be on each individual player not not to screw this up, not to put themselves and therefore their teammates at risk. And, you know, Duncan Keith was pretty firm about that. And, you know, when Duncan Keith talks, everyone in that room listens.
Lastly, Laz, as we let you go, any further insight into who's in charge of the Blackhawks right now and when anybody is actually going to come out and talk and address some of these, you know, the off-ice issues regarding the name and the logo and everything they said? There wasn't a name on that press release.
Yeah, you know, Danny Wirtz has been the president of the Blackhawks for 2 months now, I think, and he has not spoken publicly to anybody. I have an open invitation to talk to him whenever I want. Whenever he wants to talk, I'm here. I'm sure I'm not the only reporter that's done that. It's strange how they're doing it. Everything I've heard is they're taking their time. They're being very deliberate. I don't expect Danny Wirtz to be himself the long-term president of the Blackhawks. I think they're trying to figure out what they want to do next. But, everybody's on one-year contracts other than Stan Bowman and Al McIsaac. It's just all out there. And they're trying to figure out what to do next and where to take the team. I think they're going to wait until this little tournament is over, and then they're going to have a few months of an off season with free agency and the draft crammed in there in October. And they're going to reassess the entire state of the franchise and what they're going to do. Do they want a president of hockey ops? Do they want another business president? How will Danny Wirtz be involved? Will he be kind of an advisory role? Will he be in charge? There's so many things for them to figure out. And, you know, it's frustrating that nobody's talking, but they are. If you're a Hawks fan, I guess it's encouraging that they're taking their time. They're not rushing into this and just hiring some guy off the street. They're trying to figure out what this franchise needs going forward, and it's a big decision to make because it might involve taking a step back before you can take a step forward.
Laz, thanks for your time as always, man. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Dad.
That is Mark Lazarus of The Athletic following the Chicago Blackhawks. We have the Midday Midway coming up next. We missed something yesterday. Yesterday was a National Something Day, so we're going to celebrate that a day late. We have news from the Tiger King front. Carol Baskin has another roadside zoo in her sights, and maybe the ultimate addition of Daredevil or Dumbass. And I'm going to ask this question because somebody did something and I saw the video and I was astonished and then thought, what is wrong with this person? So we're going to give you one of the ultimate examples of Daredevil or Dumbass as part of the Midday Midway coming your way next on The Score.
This is Chicago's number one sports station, dominating Chicago sports talk for nearly three decades. 670 The Score is Chicago sports. Chicago sports is 670 The Score. Radio.com sports station. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago sports station.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel
the Midday Midway with Dan Bernstein on The Score.
It is Midday Midway time here on Sports Radio 670. We began the show discussing the absence of Corey Crawford from Blackhawks practice and the tone that Jeremy Colliton took, not sounding like he expects him back. So even if you were just sort of letting yourself be unrealistically optimistic for the Blackhawks' chances, pretty hard to do so knowing that it's either going to be Malcolm Subban or Colin Delia or maybe Kevin Lankinen backstopping any of these opportunities. So we also discussed college football. We heard from Greg Sankey of the SEC and sort of what he's doing as realism is creeping in to the business plans of those who run college football because they have no choice, because they see what's happening in so many of these states and the numbers all going in the wrong direction and the graph is spiraling out of control, the curve completely unflattened. And I'm hoping that somewhere in that Venn diagram of the really dumb, really mean, really selfish and misinformed people and where that intersects with people who love them, their local college football, that maybe some of these issues, if you tie the two together and say, if you want dear old state and you want your Saturdays, wear a mask no matter what some of these unfortunate news outlets may be telling you. So that was discussed. Emma Bacchellari of Sports Illustrated talked about MLB testing, and Mark Lazarus gave us his thoughts and his descriptions of Blackhawks practice yesterday. I can't believe we missed this, but yesterday was National French Fry Day. You know, it'd be the kind of thing that were we in the studio, we would have probably, you know, gotten French fries. And I think it's really hard to have a bad French fry. It's very difficult to do. Now, personally, anything that's an actual cut potato fry that's cooked properly, I'm pretty much down with. I'm not a fan of the extruded fries, which is the equivalent of a Pringle, where that's where, like you said, some of the curly fries and some of the fries that are that have been a like a pulped or mashed potato that is then put back together in fry form and fried. Not really a fan of those. I'll tolerate them if I have to. But I think it's really hard to have bad French fries. Although Burger King comes really close.
And Wendy's tastes like cardboard.
But Wendy's, they tried. Wendy's changed theirs. They did a skin-on sea salt version that's actually pretty good.
Yeah, all right. I'm going to agree to disagree. I'm a big fan of Wendy's and everything they do, but the fries leave a little bit to be desired. But still, they're fries that are pretty good. My favorite are the Red Robin steak fries. Those are probably, pound for pound, my favorite fries, and they're unlimited. If you go there, they'll just keep bringing them as long as you keep asking.
Really?
And then I love the Portillo's crinkle cut fries. Those are great too.
I like crinkle cut fries in general. There's a little pizza place near me that does. There's a place here. Some of my favorite fries, and everybody's got good local fries at different places. Al's Beef has great fries. The only problem is they're incredibly expensive. Like if you just ordered French fries there and you could end up spending, you know, $20 if it's just, you know, my kid and me, because they also do like a chili fry kind of thing, which is a meal in and of itself. I've become a huge poutine fan just because it's awesome and salty and in Canada it counts as like a school meal. But Al's are great fries. There's also a pizzeria near me in like Old Irving Park area called Tano's. Their fries are absolutely amazing. And
You're getting good fries, Dan, when it's the bag with the potato chef on it. It's the chef standing on one foot with his legs crossed, kind of presenting to you the fries, and he's got a chef's hat on. You know they're going to be good. Anything served in that bag is delicious.
Yeah, one of my youthful pleasures was every once in a while we'd go to Highland Park, and I know that people love Michael's, and Michael's is great. Their cheddar fries are amazing. But for years, the old Stosh's in Highland Park, it was just a counter. It was just like this wooden counter, and you'd go in there. There were a couple of stands there. But I would order it. It was a paper bag, and I would get the paper bag of fries and just salt them in the bag. And by the time I was done, the bag was kind of getting translucent. And the grease was seeping through, but I can smell. It's like Proustian fashion that if I smell good hand cut French fries, and it reminds me, and I get that flashback to those days at Stosh's, I know I'm in for something good. But you know what, McDonald's, it's a different thing. It's not a true fry in the same regard as some of those actual hand cut dropped fries that you get at a good hot dog stand, but there's nothing wrong with McDonald's fries right out of the fryer and properly salted. Carol Baskin is going after another roadside zoo.
Hey, you cool cats and kittens.
Hey, yeah, you killed your husband. Joe Exotic's nemesis, who became famous after the Netflix hit Tiger King, now has the Wakatee Zoo in South Carolina firmly in her sights. It was referred to by PETA, boy, to PETA stories 2 days in a row, as the worst roadside zoo in America. Baskin said, "I'm outraged the wild animals at Wakatee Zoological Farm in Myrtle Beach are suffering it needlessly, and the USDA is doing nothing about it." According to the Assistant Director of Public Affairs for the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, they are licensed, the Wakatee Farm, and their last inspection was March 5th of 2020. But the inspection report was hardly clean, noting one adult female zebu and two adult llamas had significantly overgrown hooves. So did Carol Baskin, oddly enough. But they said the shelters for the zebu cattle and peccaries are like javelinas are peccaries, for example. They were excessively soiled and muddy. So a literal pigsty was excessively soiled and muddy. Think how that has to be. It is actually a pigsty. The shelters for peccaries. Excessively soiled and muddy. It's a 500-acre zoo where on the website they say herds of buffalo and zebra roam the grassland, while big cats like the lion, cougar, and tiger eye you up close. However, apparently one of the tigers, and according to reports and videos, a tiger, Lila, has large bald spots all over her body. And Carol Baskin said, I'm especially concerned for the health and well-being of Lila. She appears to be enduring great suffering from an apparent medical condition that's left her nearly bald. Who wants to go to a zoo and see a bald tiger? What's interesting about that? And an employee at the
Wockets...
This employee said Lila is on medication for alopecia, a medical condition that contributes to hair loss. Well, it is hair loss. But he says otherwise happy. Okay, so it's a bald tiger, but it's a bald and happy tiger, apparently. Yeah, all right. Those roadside zoos are terrifying and sad. And I remember, God, I was a little kid. I might have been 7 years old on a Florida vacation. And we stopped. Sorry, something got recommended. And I remember, and my parents said, you know, we're leaving right now. We have to get out of here. And I didn't quite understand why. I just saw animals and saw, but it was so bad that they didn't want to be there anymore, and they didn't want to see it. Just like, yep, back in the car. We're out of here. Because it used to be the absolute Wild West. You know, Carl Hiaasen has worked some of that stuff into so many of his novels. And it's, I'm not saying I'm necessarily rooting for Carol Baskin, because I think she's kind of probably a murderer, I think. Based on everything that we kind of know and the documents that were shown and all that, but that said, it still would be a good thing to shut all these roadside zoos down and maybe do away with most zoos, kind of, because it doesn't. I don't know. I know in the interest of science, you want to have some of these animals saved and preserved and all that, but I'm getting to a different place on the idea of zoos in general. All right, I mentioned Daredevil or Dumbass. You got to check out this video. This is from the Daily Star, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing here. But of course, it takes place in Australia, and it's only Australians that would react in the way that they did. A massive great white shark has been filmed lunging at a fishing boat before taking chunks out of it in a heart-stopping encounter caught on camera. And you're going to need a bigger boat. Brothers Lee and Adam Ferguson were fishing for snapper off Karnak Island in Perth on Friday when they noticed the great white shark trailing behind their boat.
Holy heck!
Adam had spotted what he thought was a big fish in what they call the Burley Trail, which is a trail of bait. It's chum. It's the bait that's dropped at intervals to lure fish close. It soon became apparent it was a great white who wasn't afraid to get up close and personal. It swam figure eights around the boat for 15 minutes. Then it rammed the vessel and bit the motor. So Lee Ferguson yells at it like it's a stray dog. Goes, oi, oi, go away. Then he takes his GoPro in his hand and puts it in the water next to the shark's mouth. And you've got to see the video here, because the footage is the full, it's like something out of a movie. I mean, the full jaws wide open, chomping on the boat. And he says, yeah, it was a couple times it got too close. I tried to give him a poke with the GoPro and couldn't budge him at all. So, yeah, he's very heavy, very strong. It's a great white shark!
Yes,
they're very heavy and very strong. So they had to pull up anchor and sail away. And then they showed the remnants of it where it was chomping on the boat. He said he never felt unsafe around the shark, despite placing his hand in the line of fire. Well, whether he felt unsafe, that really isn't the point. He said it was uncomfortable, but we didn't feel in immediate danger. I mean, we'll put this in the Twitter feed, but you were in immediate danger, whether you felt it or not. But man, good on you. But that is our ultimate edition of Daredevil or Dumbass. You go ahead and be the judge.
Can I vote?
Yes.
Dumbass.
Right? But he literally yells at it like it was a seagull on the beach or just some annoyance. Aye, go away! And it was like a 15-foot great white shark that's literally chewing on his boat. I just sent it into the group chat. So if you want to put that up at Bernstein670 on Twitter, just so people can see the photo of this, it is it's remarkable. So please,
I put up a daredevil or dumbass poll right now, so it's up there already. If people want to vote,
dumbass.
Outstanding. Yeah, I'm going to go with that too. I'm so excited for our next guest because there's a wonderful book out called The Wax Pack that was written by Brad Baluchian, and it's his story of ordering an unopened Topps 1986 pack of baseball cards, and then upon opening it and going through it, he then tracked down where all of the players in the pack are now and drove around the country spending time with them and interviewing them, and it became a fascinating and very human book called The Wax Pack. So we're going to talk to the author next on The Score.
This is 670 The Score, Chicago's number one and most listened to sports station, period. Thanks for keeping us on top, Chicago.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.